It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A lawsuit filed Wednesday alleges that a 5-year-old girl in Outagamie County was sexually targeted by adult users on the popular free video game platform Roblox. The suit joins more than 20 similar cases around the country. That's according to a review by the New York Times.
As reported by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the lawsuit alleges that the child was sexually exploited by several adults who presented themselves as children within the game. The suit argues that this abuse was enabled by a game that lacks adequate protections for this kind of abuse.
Roblox has more than 110 million daily users. It has faced scrutiny for years about the proliferation of child predators on the app. Kentucky's attorney general filed a civil lawsuit against the company on Tuesday, calling it a website of choice for child predators. In statements, the company says it has improved protections for children.
To unpack the risk to kids on Roblox and in the social media landscape, Justin Patchen is with us, professor in the Department of Political Science and Criminal Justice at UW-Eau Claire and co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. Justin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm happy to be with you, Rob. Thank you.
Now, some people out there are very familiar with Roblox, maybe play on it themselves or their kids do. Some don't. A key thing here is this isn't just a game you sit down and you're not connected with the world. You're playing things that are designed by other people. There's interaction. Like many games, you're interacting with the rest of the world. How common is exploitation on platforms like these, on gaming platforms, where there is this, in effect, social element?
Well, it definitely does happen. And the unique thing about Roblox is it's basically a platform that has thousands of sort of mini games that you can play. So while Roblox has some control over these experiences, the creators create these mini games, and some games have more kind of protections than others. Of course, Roblox does have global protections that parents can use to help keep their kids safe. But there's always going to be bad actors out there. And Roblox is one of the fastest growing platforms out there. So it's going to attract these people who want to cause others harm.
We have this growing number of lawsuits, and it looks like law firms are expected to file more. We've got 3 state attorneys general at least filing suits on this. That's kind of the evidence we have. How much do we know about how common this kind of abuse of kids could be on a platform like Roblox?
Well, we don't know a lot. We do know that the public reports of these types of incidents seems to be growing. And this isn't altogether uncommon when it comes to these relatively new platforms, right? They're growing rapidly and they're trying hard to keep up in terms of the protections, but there's always going to be, you know, some negative experiences, and parents need to watch out for that. But, you know, when these things happen, we do hear about them, and, you know, these lawsuits shed some light on what's occurring, but also are an attempt to hold these companies accountable for the vulnerabilities that exist, you know, in the games and platforms.
You've written research delving into the risks that American youth have in so-called metaverse-type environments, right, where you go in and you're really immersed in this thing and a lot of different ways to interact with people. What kind of things did you find?
That's right. So my research partner, Samir Hinduja, and I sort of pride ourselves on trying to be on the cutting edge of technology with respect to what youth are interested in. And so we've been looking at the metaverse, we've been looking at generative AI, we've been looking at these new immersive environments to try to figure out how mistreatment is occurring. And probably no surprise to your listeners that, you know, if youth are on these platforms, there's likely to be negative experiences. So the thing about the metaverse environment is it's becoming even more realistic than you can imagine. And while, you know, Meta and other companies are trying to keep these platforms as safe as possible, the technology is just advancing so quickly that, you know, I alluded to it earlier, there's always going to be those bad actors who, you know, exploit these vulnerabilities and, you know, create fake images and distribute images of others that have been modified, creating, you know, harmful speech using some of these tools. So all the ways that you can use these tools for positive aspects of your life, they can be used for negative as well.
I'm going to get into some advice for parents in just a minute, but I want to start with the platforms themselves. What kind of responsibility do you think Roblox or Meta or whoever's operating the site that kids want to be on, that kids are on, what responsibility do they have to ensure those kids' safety?
All of these platforms certainly have an obligation to provide tools to users, and when it comes to children, their parents, to make these environments as safe as possible. So even with Roblox, they have the ability for... So you have to be over the age of 13 to have your own account on Roblox. Otherwise, parents have to set up these accounts if you're under 13. And Roblox allows parents to block any game, any experience. They allow them to block chatting. So you can be on Roblox without interacting with other people, chatting or interacting through voice chat or different tools. So there are ways to limit the extent to which these negative experiences happen. So that's sort of the bare minimum, though. And I think the future really is trying to provide a more viable age verification system that would help out in some of these situations. But for sure, social media companies also need to be cooperative with law enforcement when these really negative experiences happen to hold the offenders accountable.
Now, one theme I've seen in some of these lawsuits is the second location phenomenon, where this might start on Roblox, but then in what is otherwise a friendly, harmless chat, it moves to Discord, right? A link is set or some other platform for communication. And that's less in the eye of the platform that created this thing in the first place. Is that part of the problem as you see it, like taking it to another place that's harder to track?
That's exactly right. And so even if these sort of mainstream platforms are doing a relatively good job of trying to, you know, keep users safe, there's always in the chat function, you could say, go to this particular website. Here's the URL for my camera. There are ways to circumvent the protections in these mainstream platforms to go in darker spaces that parents have no idea about. And so this does speak to the role of parents in having conversations with their children about what they're doing online. And one of the sort of warnings would be is, you know, don't go off Roblox, let's say, to this other platform that has less controls, and you never know what's going to happen in those environments.
Talking to Justin Patchen from UW-Eau Claire about kids' safety online after an Outagamie County family filed a lawsuit against the gaming platform Roblox. Justin, you just mentioned you and your colleague are going full tilt to try to keep up with the cutting edge. Well, now parents... How do they keep up with this, right? What would you say to parents to get started, given the constantly changing, ever-proliferating variety of games and platforms out there?
You know, Rob, I live and breathe this stuff, and I have a hard time keeping up. And so, yes, I get it. As parents, it's really hard to keep up. But we have to be tenacious in our questioning of our kids about what they're doing online, especially young, you know, kids under the age of, let's say, 16. So ask the question, what are they doing on these apps? Who are they communicating with? Do they know how to use the tools to block people, to report people? But number one, I think the most important thing for parents to do is to cultivate the kind of relationship with their child where if something bad does happen online, they feel comfortable, they feel safe turning to the parent. Because when the real bad things happen online, like, you know, some of the nature of some of these lawsuits, it's these kids find themselves in these situations. They make a mistake. They do something they probably know they shouldn't have done. They don't feel comfortable coming to mom or dad. And then they just dig themselves a deeper hole. So, you know, we need to tell our kids, look, if you make a mistake or if you go somewhere you knew you weren't supposed to be, come to me immediately and we'll sort it out. We'll fix it and we'll make it so it doesn't get any worse. So that relationship is probably the key thing.
So say a parent's getting ready to hand their kid the keys to Roblox. Maybe they're under 13, so it's the parent's account. Step by step, what do you think that kid should know? Should the parent be playing with them from time to time to keep tabs on this?
Absolutely, especially early on. And I did this too. So I have some nieces that were playing Roblox, and this was a couple of years ago, and I wanted to sort of figure out how it worked. And so I would play with them. And we wouldn't be in the chat, we would be on our phones so we could play with our relatives without having to worry about other people messaging us or chatting with us. So go online, understand the game, just spend a little bit of time so you know what they're involved in and ask the questions. Do you know who that person is? Do you know how to block that person if they start saying something inappropriate? The more they can be in these online spaces with their kids, the better.
And the thing you mentioned earlier, preparing kids to spot something that's wrong and to be able to report that's going to be a skill, right, that's going to be there regardless of whatever the next Roblox or next social media phenomenon is.
100% right. Yeah. So we're not really training our kids for a particular app because the apps will change. You might even tell them you're not allowed to go on Roblox and they might listen to you. Hopefully they will, but they'll go on to some other app that you don't know about that you didn't prohibit and they'll run into similar, probably worse problems. So we need to equip them with skills that would apply to all of the online experiences. Because it's a moving target for sure.
I've been booking you for talk shows, Justin, since your cyberbullying book came out like, 15, 16 years ago now. What has really stood out to you as to how threats to kids have evolved in that time period?
Well, the more things change, the more they stay the same. These behaviors are still happening. Unfortunately, I still have a job. I'm still doing the research, all the books and studies later. It's still happening and it's increasing, unfortunately. I think because of shows like this and others, parents are more aware of the problem. So I think that's a good thing. But as the technology evolves, there's just more creative ways to cause harm to others. And, parents, teachers, law enforcement, and youth themselves have to be sort of vigilant in protecting against these behaviors.
Justin, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
That's Justin Patchen, professor in the Department of Political Science and Criminal Justice at UW-Eau Claire. He's co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center, and he joined us for a look at a Wisconsin lawsuit against the gaming platform Roblox and wider concerns about kids' safety online.
Coming up, how could Wisconsin firms be affected by the White House's new $100,000 fee for H-1B visas? Hear from an immigration attorney.
Employers like to plan well in advance, so it has been very taxing on them to literally not even know where this fee applies or how to pay it.
And reaction from a Milwaukee business group, that's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The White House is imposing a $100,000 fee for each new H-1B visa application. Those visas are for highly skilled workers in specialty occupations.
Previously, it cost employers a few thousand dollars per application, depending on the size of the company. That's according to the research group American Immigration Council.
In recent days, a group of healthcare providers, religious organizations, and educators filed a lawsuit to stop the new H-1B fee, saying it would harm hospitals, churches, schools, and industries that rely on the visa.
Big tech companies are the primary user. For a look at how this visa fee increase could affect the business community here in Wisconsin, we're joined by Dale Coinga, president and CEO of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce. Dale, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Your coalition represents about 2,000 member businesses employing roughly, 300,000 people throughout southeastern Wisconsin and well beyond that. What have you been hearing so far about how they're going to navigate the new H-1B visa fee?
Well, just taking a step back before we specifically dive into H-1B visas, it's important to recognize the region and our nation has a larger demographic challenge. And there's only three ways to really grow an economy. One is by extracting wealth from the earth. That's really not what we do much in Wisconsin. That's mining and oil and things like that. Two is productivity. We're very, very good at productivity economic gains in Wisconsin. And three is by having a growing workforce or a growing population. And immigration is an important part of how the region and America in general has continued to grow our economy faster than many other countries, especially Western Europe and other advanced economies like Japan. So when you look at this specific program, this is a very specific program that has not received a lot of criticism in the past because the criteria are very specific that you need to have high skill and the company also has to show and demonstrate that they have a very difficult time filling these positions organically. And it's good for the overall economy. We've had the international talent come here and do everything from provide information technology services in Fortune 500 companies and even be teaching in places like Milwaukee Public Schools.
So there are a range of different, different places of employment. And as what I'm hearing from you is that these are specialty occupations, meaning that these are specialties that would be really hard to find here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, we just don't have, it's an interesting position to be in as an economy is when your economy is doing well, you sometimes don't have all the talent you need to go to the next level. And just a general commentary on where we're at is that if we have more people, we will have faster economic growth. So at a micro level, what's happening here is companies are saying, we want to grow in order to keep growing here in America and here in the region. We need to bring in talent to give us those critical needs. And if you really look at what we call the second or third order effects of this, if you don't do that, ultimately you risk companies moving abroad or at least outsourcing portions of their information technology or other skill sets abroad. Accounting could be one, finance. But if you have this program here, then you're going to get these individuals to come here, invest here, and the company to invest here through these individuals.
So with the fee going into effect on September 21st, in recent weeks, have your member businesses changed anything in their practices?
Well, they're still assessing. We asked around about this. But just if you take a common sense look at this, is that not all businesses and industries run on the same margin. And what I mean by that is this: the new fee, which is now six figures, is probably not going to have a prohibiting impact on the FANGs. Those are the Facebooks, Amazons, Netflix, Googles, companies that have billions and billions of dollars of capital and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on this talent are probably not going to be deterred from the high fee. But the reality is a lot of companies that rely upon these are not high margin tech companies with billions of dollars in capital. A lot of companies that rely upon this are more traditional and they are in more mature industries that have lower margins. And when you look at an upfront fee, just before you even hire them or onboard them or train them or move them or pay them their regular salary, about $100,000, our fear is that it's prohibitively expensive for companies in the Midwest where the cost of living is lower, the margin for mature industries is lower, and therefore it will have a disproportional impact on places like the Midwest that have these more mature industries.
And when you talk about tech companies and infusing tech, one of your member businesses, Fiserv, is the top employer with approved H-1B visas by far in Wisconsin. What impact might Fiserv have? What have you heard from them?
Well, Fiserv have not specifically spoken to Fiserv in detail about the program, playing phone tag on that one. But just in general, you have to understand that Fiserv is an international company. Mm-hmm. And so when you have international companies, there's going to be a clear assessment financially to ask the question, is that with that type of fee, does it make sense to bring them to Milwaukee, Wisconsin? Or does it make sense to keep them in other parts of the world where nearly all large companies have the ability to outsource parts of their workforce?
So in closing, what is your next step as a business group on this issue?
Well, we are speaking to our member companies to assess what position they are in on this. I'll give you an example is Milwaukee Public Schools, who we work with closely, want to see them succeed. Before this decision was made, they were moving away from the program for a variety of different reasons. So that was one of the larger, they were one of the larger users of this program. And then the companies that are using it, we're getting feedback on what their lobbying efforts are on this and how can we be helpful. Once that analysis is done, we'll communicate to our congressman and communicate to members of the executive branch we have relationships with, is the full impact of this, and then lobby to minimize the impact of this. Because generally speaking, across all types of programs, is we want to see more talent in our market that goes into the workforce and are able to be productive members of our community.
Dale, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That is Dale Coenga, president and CEO of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce. He joined us for a look at how the Trump administration's new $100,000 H-1B visa fee will impact Wisconsin businesses. Now for a look at this visa system and how it works, we turn to Grant Sovereign, a partner and immigration attorney at Milwaukee-based Quarles & Brady, who is helping clients file their H-1B petitions. Grant, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So on Friday, a nationwide coalition of healthcare providers and religious groups and university professors and other firms filed this federal lawsuit over the Trump administration's H-1B visa fee. What is your reaction to this legal response to the program?
Well, I think that the plaintiffs in this case, which, like you said, are healthcare organizations, other employers, are probably right. And because this is a $100,000 fee that pretty clearly, just by its very nature, isn't at all related to the cost of processing the H-1B petitions that employers file on behalf of potential employees. And the law does require that any filing fee has to be related to what it costs to get it done. So what these plaintiffs are alleging makes a lot of sense is that it really isn't related to it all. But I also would point out that it doesn't even seem like the government is so committed to this $100,000 fee. On a Friday night, 2 weeks ago, they announced this $100,000 fee. And on the following Monday, they issued proposed regulations for how H-1Bs should run going forward, which did not even include the $100,000 fee. And they have still not made available the means by which anybody should pay the $100,000 fee. So even though it purportedly went into effect on September 21st, there is no way to pay that fee or to show someone that you paid it so you could get into the country if you have an H-1B. So I'm highly skeptical that it will actually go into effect.
And there is all this confusion about how the system works and how the lottery system works to bring on these type of workers. Can you give us any glimpse into how the system works with the lottery?
Right. It does sound like, you know, if there's any, what would be the main reason to hire a foreign worker to the United States? Immediately or maybe politically, people assume that it's to bring people in at lower wages, because why else would an American company do this? But the reality of how the lottery works and how H-1Bs work in general is that certainly for the state of Wisconsin, but even throughout the whole country, the majority of H-1B workers are people who went to university here in the United States. So they may have been, they were obviously born somewhere else, but they come to go get their undergraduate degree or a graduate degree at a U.S. university. In the U.S., they have a foreign student visa, usually an F1 or a J1. They graduate from school, they find a job, and that's when an employer says, wow, they're really a great employee, and we have enough need in this particular area that we're willing to pay the legal fees and the existing government filing fees, which altogether could be anywhere between $5,000 and $10,000 to hire somebody like this. So the prevailing political opinion that these are workers who were bringing to the United States to pay less money just is patently false. There is a regulatory requirement that in order to get an H-1B approved, you must prove, the employer must prove, that it is paying the prevailing wage to that worker, which means the average wage for that particular job in that particular geographic area. We're not talking about minimum wage of $7.25. We're talking about whatever the federal government's Bureau of Labor Statistics says is the average wage for that particular job, whether it's in Manitowoc or Milwaukee or wherever it is. They look at exactly what that is. So you literally regulatorily cannot hire somebody at a lower wage that would depress the wages of other American workers.
But it seems as if the employer must take a lot of extra steps to communicate why this employee would be essential to their organization.
They do have to show, I mean, the basic requirements are that the employee must have at least a bachelor's degree in a field related to the position, and that the position must always require at least a bachelor's degree in that related field. That's where the term specialty occupation comes from. So you're right. You do have to prove that both the employer normally requires that and the employee has that. But then there is a lot of extra paperwork. And, you know, we call it paperwork, but that's why Congress came up with this rule. They did not want to just bring in anybody to the United States who would depress American workers, who would throw people out of their jobs for the most part, you know, when they came up with this. So the paperwork is about making sure that they're not displacing other workers, that there hasn't been a layoff or there hasn't been any other sort of employment action at that employer where there's a strike going on. You have to show that you're paying the prevailing wage. You have to post the wages at the employer's work site so that other employees can see we're hiring this worker at this wage. Notify the Department of Labor if you think this is lower than what Americans work at so that, you know, we know that they are abiding by the rules. So there are a lot of paperwork costs, the fees, hiring a lawyer, doing all this extra work, that it's just kind of a baked in disincentive for an employer to just use this as a way to pay people less or to get cheap employees. There are a lot of costs to do it that no employer, especially in Wisconsin, is going to try and hire somebody in this situation with these extra costs that exist.
What will happen to people in Wisconsin who are currently here on this type of visa? What about when they want to renew?
Well, that's what we're waiting to hear, either from this lawsuit or more specifics from the government. There are first-time H-1Bs who, like you suggested, in the lottery, there are usually around 300,000 employers every year who ask for a first-time H-1B, but only 85,000 new H-1Bs are available each year. So obviously, it's only a 20 or 30% chance that you even get selected. Those are the ones it seems like the government wants to apply this $100,000 fee to. But there are other people then who are extending their H-1B because they already got it the first time and are not subject to the lottery. Or there are H-1B petitions where you're moving from one employer to another. It seems relatively clear that the latter two do not require the $100,000 fee, that it may be just first-time H-1Bs. So we're hopeful that the people who already have them can keep planning their travel or keep planning to work here in the U.S., that it may only apply to the first timers.
Can you speak to non-tech companies in this moment, the nonprofits of the world, you know, even churches or schools, what they might be going through, or hospitals trying to hire nurses, for instance?
I mean, if you look at the top 10 most employers who are using H-1B visas, new H-1B visas in Wisconsin, you can see that there is a little bit of a tech, but also healthcare bent or education bent. So healthcare, technology, education are the highest users of H-1Bs. And by the way, when we say the highest, the one employer who uses the most in Wisconsin only got 336 new ones last year. So we're not talking about tens of thousands of people that even make a splash in our economy. There are 2,000 or so H-1B workers in Wisconsin, and there are 3 million workers total. So you can see this is a very tiny, tiny amount that mostly employers are only hiring if they really need somebody because of these extra costs. But you're exactly right. We see people who are in areas that just can't find enough people. I think of one of the most impressive programs for immigration are foreign doctors who work in primary care in northern Wisconsin, where it is extremely difficult to find doctors to work in internal medicine primary care, that doctors who have H-1Bs are able to work in those places that could be dramatically affected by this. And, you know, we're talking, again, in an unemployment rate in Wisconsin of already the one of the lowest in the country at 3.1%. We're talking about turning away 2,000 people who work in very specialized fields in places like that in northern Wisconsin. But you're right. There are nonprofits. There are governments. Like, teachers have in Madison and Milwaukee have the public school systems have a hard time finding enough teachers in specialized areas that they can find people through this.
Very quickly here, you're skeptical that this $100,000 fee will actually gain some traction and become part of the program. So is this a wait and see moment for your clients? What are next steps?
It is very difficult. It's wait and see, but employers like to plan well in advance. So it has been very taxing on them to literally not even know where this fee applies or how to pay it. So they are waiting and seeing, but this lottery, you only get to apply for new H-1Bs one time a year in April. So if we don't have something more clear by then, it's going to be a practical problem.
Grant, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That is Grant Sovereign, partner and immigration attorney at Milwaukee-based Quarles & Brady. Earlier, we heard from Dale Coinga, president and CEO of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce. We've been talking about the potential impact of the Trump administration's new $100,000 H-1B visa fee on Wisconsin employers.
Coming up, a Stoughton native was on a solo glacier hike in Norway that went horribly wrong.
First I was sliding, then I was rolling, then I was bouncing off of rocks and stuff and just picking up more and more and more speed. And I thought, you know, this is it. This is the moment.
Alec Loon survived 6 days seriously injured in the wilderness. He shares his story next on WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a refugee's journey to Wisconsin.
It was 50 years ago that the city of Saigon was captured by the North Vietnamese, marking the end of the Vietnam War. Just days before, 12-year-old Tan Pham escaped the city, along with his parents and three siblings. Pham shared the story of his family's extraordinary journey to La Crosse with WPR's Ezra Wall.
Toward the end of the war, 1975, my parents' kids, the four of us, were still living with my grandparents. They did not want to be separated from their kids. So from the city, they traveled to my grandparents' house. Remember, it was 150 miles away. So on the way back to their house in the city, he ran into one of his friends who's in the Navy. And that friend of his told my dad, I can get you into a ship right now, but that means that you cannot go home and pack. So instead of going to my parents' house in the city, my dad can see the chaos. So of course, any war, toward the end of the war, there are chaos, people running around. So he decided to let's go onto this Navy ship. And we left the country 3 days before the fall of Saigon.
What was your experience of that wartime?
To give you an example of the daily lives in the village, every night the local militia have to go around the village and set booby traps so that the enemy cannot get into the village. In the morning, their job then is to go and pick up all of those booby traps so that the local villagers can get back out into the field and do their daily work, like raising corn, rice, whatever that they do. Well, once in a while, you would hear a boom. And What does that mean? It means that they forgot one of the trap. So it probably means that someone got killed. When I was living in the village with my grandparents, those are the things that we experience every day.
12 years old, no warning. You don't even get to go home to pack. All of a sudden, you're heading to a new country. Where was the first place you came after you left Vietnam? Did you come right to the States?
No. The naval ship that we were on, that went over to the Philippines. And, of course, the U.S. naval base in Philippines took over the ship. So at that point, everybody on that ship became refugees.
And so eventually you find your way to La Crosse, then grew up here, basically, after you were like 13 or 14 years old?
Yes. When we came to the United States, we just have the clothes on our back, right? Because we didn't go home and pack. We didn't have any money. We live in low-income housing for 6 months. My parents knew that we can't live here forever. So both of them went out, get a job, saved enough money to buy the house that they live for almost 50 years. And then us went to school. So I grew up going to school at St. Pius, Aquinas High School, and then eventually came to UWL, got my degree.
After you left Vietnam, right before the fall of Saigon, how long was it before you were able to travel back to Vietnam?
When we left Vietnam, my dad did not send word back to Vietnam that we're okay. So for a period of 9 years, my grandparents knew that they said goodbye to us. But then why didn't they hear from us for 9 years? They couldn't help but think that maybe a family of six just got wiped out. So 9 years later, my dad sent word back to Vietnam that the family of six, that we're still alive. So I left there in 1975. Went back for the very first time with my mom in 1999. And my grandmother was so happy to see her first grandson, me, walking up the road up to her house, because all along she thought that we were dead.
Tan Pham talked with WPR's Ezra Wall in La Crosse. After retiring from a career in IT, Pham now runs a business called Cuisine Adventure Tours, which plans trips to Vietnam. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News.
In a solo hiking trip gone wrong, Alec Loon was trapped on a remote mountain with multiple serious injuries in Norway's Folgefonna National Park.
He spent 6 days waiting for rescue before being evacuated by helicopter and then taken to recover in a nearby hospital.
Alec Loon is a climate reporter based out of London. He grew up in Stoughton and is a UW-Madison alum. Alec, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here.
First of all, Alec, how are you doing now with recovering from some fairly serious injuries?
Yeah, it's been a rough ride, and to be honest, the ride is still going on to an extent because, my legs are kind of still healing from all of this, and I'm still pretty incapacitated. I can walk around, take a few steps, but, you know, when I go out of the house, I go in a wheelchair, and my legs are kind of trying to recover from both breaking the femur, but then also the frostbite injuries to my feet. So yeah, it's a lot, and it's going to take a long time to recover from. So that's the new challenge that I'm facing right now. The ride is continuing.
Well, if you're willing to relive the experience with us a little bit, you're someone who's done a lot of hiking in far northern conditions. Plus, you're reporting what ended up happening on this hike in Norway.
Well, in short, I basically went ahead when I probably should have turned back. I had a bit of an equipment malfunction. You know, I wanted to backpack around the northern half of this glacier in this national park. So it was the first day. I headed up the valley,
saw the first tongue of the glacier where, you know, this is amazing ice fall that's coming down the mountain. There's waterfalls around it. And I kind of took a very faint path up through the brush, had to scramble a lot. I wanted to get a bit further before I camped for the night because I was going to go into the next valley the next day and I wanted to get over towards that valley. What was really the problem was, I think, was that my boot had torn apart. The sole started coming off my hiking boot. You know, it was the first day out. I really didn't want to go back to the city. So rather than turning around, I used some athletic tape that I had to tape up that sole, to tape it to the boot. But, you know, in doing that, I had this tape kind of on the bottom of the sole. So I think it reduced the traction a bit, is my hypothesis. Anyway, I was coming along this really steep slope, and suddenly I took a step and slipped. And I'm not sure exactly how I slipped, but the next thing I knew, I was flying down the mountain. First, I was sliding, then I was rolling, then I was bouncing off of rocks and stuff and just picking up more and more and more speed. And I thought, this is it. This is the moment. This is really, really bad. You know, this is like what you see in the movies or read about in books. You know, this is the start of something really bad.
So you were there ultimately 6 days. You broke a femur, among other injuries. What kind of things over the course of that were going through your mind as you were, A, trying to stay alive, and B, hoping to be found in this remote area?
Yeah, so my fall came to an end when I crashed into a rock and snapped my femur in half. Also fractured my pelvis, fractured a couple vertebrae in my back. So basically, yeah, I kind of grabbed my backpack, made sure I had that with me, slid down the mountain a little bit more, and just then, you know, once I had come to a full stop, put my head on my backpack and just passed out. When I woke up the next morning is when I really took stock of the situation. And I looked up the mountain and I saw that some of my gear was kind of spread out. And so I thought, okay, I need to get up to my stuff and find my cell phone because I've got my backpack with me, but there's more stuff up the mountain. And that's, you know, that I tried to scoot up the mountain, but I just couldn't. It was too painful and didn't have enough force to push myself up the mountain. So I ended up having to just stay exactly where I was, basically. I thought, okay, well, I'm probably going to have to just stay here and wait for rescue to come, essentially, because I can't move out. And so then I just started thinking about, you know, logically kind of what I needed to do next. I had my camping gear, my backpack, took out my sleeping pad, inflated that, took out my sleeping bag, so I had something to keep me warm at night. And I knew that I was going to have to last 4 days because it was 4 days until my flight home. But, you know, yeah, of course, there were a lot more adventures in store over what ended up being 6 days up on the mountain.
What other adventure sticks in your mind over that obviously very painful and difficult 6 days?
So the first problem was the water, because my water had come out also out of my backpack during the fall. So I didn't have anything to drink, and it was pretty hot. It was pretty sunny, warm weather the first 3 days. So I just got thirstier and thirstier, and I had a bunch of granola bars and some peanuts and some snacks that I could eat, but my mouth was so dry, the granola just kind of turned to cement in my mouth. I couldn't even swallow it. You know, and I couldn't move, couldn't go get water. So what I ended up doing was peeing in my water pouch and drinking my own urine just to get some fluids in me. So that kept me going the first couple days. Then on the fourth day, it started raining, and a storm moved in. And so, yeah, I went from being hot and dry to being kind of cold and wet. But the key thing is that the storm kept the different rescuers from making it up to me, because, you know, as on that fourth day when I didn't make that flight, my wife Veronica raised the alarm. Norway's search and rescue, which is run by the military there, flew out on that night when the alarm was raised, but it was
such bad weather, they couldn't really do much. And then on the next day, the storm was so bad that they couldn't fly at all. So that's why it took until the sixth day for and until there was a little clear, there was a little break in the clouds. I remember seeing it. There was just the gray, dark cloudiness parted just a little bit, and there was a little bit of sun. And that was when the helicopter was able to come up the mountain and start scanning the mountain for me. And that was an incredible moment I'll never forget, where I heard this helicopter flying up the valley. It came up over the ridge, started scanning the mountain pretty close to me, a couple hundred yards away, but it didn't see me. And I started waving and yelling. And, you know, I remember hearing this kind of heavenly music behind the helicopter, because I'd been hearing these kind of auditory hallucinations, you know, thinking that I was hearing people talking nearby. And so when that helicopter arrived, I heard like heavenly music, like this was my salvation. But then the helicopter actually turned around and flew away. And I thought, okay, this is, you know, either they didn't see me and gave up, or they're just getting fuel and they're going to come back. And so that was the final adventure was when the helicopter flew away. And so at that point I said, okay, either that was my last shot, or my last shot is about to happen when the helicopter comes back. So I took off my rain jacket so I'd be in my red puffy jacket to be a bit more visible. And I put my red bandana on top of my tent pole to make kind of a flag. And then about 40 minutes later, the helicopter came back and I was waving this bandana, waving at the helicopter. And then must have been 5-10 minutes, I was waving and yelling. And then finally I saw the door of the helicopter, the side door opened up, and I saw somebody wave at me. And that's when I knew it was finally going to be over.
That's a feeling I can't imagine. What was in your brain when you finally realized, okay, they see me and they're coming for me?
I think the main thing was just relief that I was going to see my family again. That's really what had kept me going the whole time. You know, I really tried to focus on the tasks at hand and not think too much about what ifs or hypotheticals, not let my mind kind of wander or I'd drive myself insane. But the one thing I did really think about was that, you know, if I would die up on this mountain right now, my biggest regret would be not being able to spend more time with my family and friends.
Alec, I'm glad you came back, and thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Alec Loon grew up in Stoughton. He's a climate reporter and UW-Madison alum based out of London. We talked about his hiking accident in Norway over the summer and his recovery since then. Have you had a scary moment hiking in the wilderness? Or maybe some advice to help keep other people safe out there? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Again, that's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
The other day, we shared a documentary about Packers fans from Japan, and a listener named Carl emailed this story.
Carl was working for a paper-making machine company in Beloit 30 years ago, went to Wales in the UK to provide engineering support.
One of the Welsh operators asked where he was from, and Carl said, "I'm from Beloit, Wisconsin. It's north of Chicago."
The Welsh factory worker said, "Green Bay Packers! Isn't far from having a great year."
Carl writes, "That was the last response I could have imagined, so we talked Packers for a while. He knew more about the Packers season than I did."
On his next visit, Carl brought a bunch of Green Bay Packer trinkets and dumped them on the table during a tea break. He says, "You would have thought I had dumped treasure on the table in front of some young boys."
Thank you for sharing your story, Carl. And if you have encountered Packers fans around the globe, tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Beatrice Lawrence, and Royce Podeswa. Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Sarah Hopeful.
Tim Peterson is managing producer. Dean Knetter is our executive producer. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for listening to WPR News.